You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice in our republic, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. I threw the in there, our republic, in there for the Republicans who are increasingly tuning into the show and saying, I think my party's gone nuts. But they've been brainwashed into this thing about America is a republic, not a democracy, because, you know, back in the 1950s, Joe McCarthy was saying, you know, republic sounds more like Republican and democracy sounds more like Democratic, only he always called it Democrat, emphasizing the rat part. And so anyway, Greece's economy. Now, before you go, I want to talk to you before you go running away because I'm talking about Europe. Let me tell you that this has 100% everything to do with what's going on in Washington, D.C. right now and what the future of the United States is going to look like. And what we are seeing right now is that, you know, there's frankly two visions for America. The president's budget laid out one, which is let's build our country. Let's grow our way out of this debt. The debt was massive after the Civil War. Abraham Lincoln grew us out of it. Well, and Andrew Johnson and subsequent presidents. We grew our way out of that debt. Our debt was massive after World War II. In both cases, it was larger than our debt is right now as a percentage of GDP and arguably in real dollars. And we grew our way out of that debt. Harry Truman built highways and hospitals and schools, and then Dwight Eisenhower came in and said, this is a great idea, let's build more highways, and did it with borrowed money. And in fact, you know, said not only let's build hospitals and highways and schools, but let's invest in our intellectual infrastructure. We got 700,000 GIs coming back from Europe. Let's send them to college for free. Pay them $100 a month stipend. If they get married and they want to buy a house and start a family, we'll have the federal government loan them the money or backstop the money, backstop the loans through the banks so that they're guaranteed so that they can be offered at very low interest rates. My dad bought the house that he died in a few years back. He bought that house in 1956 or 57, and the interest rate on the loan was 3%. It was one of those GI Bill houses. He went to college on the GI Bill. And so these guys built us out of a depression. There was a massive depression in Europe after World War II. Its infrastructure was in tatters. Even the countries who hadn't been bombed back to the Stone Age were, you know, just in depression. There was no demand. There was no supply. There was nothing. Did Europe cut their way to prosperity? No. But they're trying to now, and this is very, very, very interesting. And this is a lesson that you need to know. From today's New York Times. The headline, this is an article by Landon Thomas Jr. The headline, Portugal's debt efforts may be a warning for Greece. Oh? Portugal? Portugal actually went along with the IMF. They said, okay, that's fine. We will cut public pensions. We will reduce pay to government workers. We'll fire a bunch of government workers. We'll stop building things. We'll cut taxes on rich people. We're going to do all these austerity things. And in exchange for that, the IMF loaned them a whole pile of money. Some, I think it was $70 billion. Yeah, 78 billion euros, $103 billion. And when they did this, the debt to GDP ratio in Portugal, the horror that caused the IMF to come in and say, and the EU to come in and say, you got to cut. Right? We're going to pursue this religion that we imposed on Chile and we imposed on Argentina, and we imposed on Mexico. And by the way, they all went bankrupt. It didn't work in the 80s in South and Central America, but we're going to try it in Europe now. Because the people who tried it back in the 80s, they're not around anymore. And we think we've got it figured out. So anyhow, it was 107%. Their GDP was 107% of their debt. Right now, our debt, you know, our GDP is around $14, $15 trillion, depending on whether or not you're in a depression. And our debt is pushing, what, 12, 13, maybe 14 trillion if you want to. It depends on where you're looking, you know, at what end point in the budget. I think right now it's around 12 and change. So we're at about 90% of GDP in terms of our debt. Portugal was at 107%. So they went in and they started slashing. Guess where they are now? 118%. Why? Because when you lay off a bunch of workers, and this is what we have seen in 25 red states in America, where over 700,000 government employees, state and county workers and city workers, have been laid off by Republican legislatures and Republican governors. In every single case, those states have seen their unemployment rates go up and their state revenues go down. Why? Because they just laid off a bunch of taxpayers who are no longer paying taxes. On the other hand, we have 24 states in the United States, run mostly by Democrats, who have actually raised taxes, increased spending, and seen their net revenues go up and their unemployment numbers go down. Things have gotten better. Things got worse in the red states. They got better in the blue states. So much better that they're dragging the whole country up. So President Obama, his, you know, the vision that he's laying out in his budget is, let's drag this country up. And the Republicans are saying, oh, God, you can't have that. We got to drag the country down. Now, why would they want to do that? First of all, let me give you some examples of, again, how this has played out. First of all, the Portugal, you know, they did this. In fact, they're going to do more of it. The finance minister, Mr. Gaspar, says that he, quoting from the New York Times here, intends to slash government pension payments by $1.6 billion. And he's going to cut the bonus payouts that public sector workers in the country have long earned. You know, basically no more Christmas bonus. Now, what's the effect of that going to be? Well, it's going to save the government some money. But where does the government get its money? From taxes. And if people aren't earning income, they're not paying taxes on that income. And perhaps more importantly is the multiplier effect. If they're not earning income, they're not spending that income. Because when a government worker in Portugal earns $1,000 in a month and goes out and spends it, they spend it in a local store. That shop owner then has $1,000 and pays some employees who are also paying taxes, pays the shopkeeper or pays the clerk and buys some inventory, and the inventory comes from a company that makes the stuff, and they have to pay salaries. And every step along, each one of those people are taxpayers. They're paying taxes. So the Portuguese are starting to say, no, you had 100,000 people out on the streets over the weekend. Spain, their debt-to-GDP ratio, again, ours is 90%. Theirs was 36% before this all began. They took an austerity hit. They started laying off people. Guess where they're at now? They were 36%. Now they're approaching 84%. Things are getting worse. And these geniuses in Europe are scratching their heads going, why are things getting worse? David Cameron in the UK. We're going to cut. We're going to do what those Republicans in America are talking about. We're going to cut. We're going to have austerity. Oh, our economy contracted by a half a point? I wonder why. You think it could have something to do with the fact that you're cutting? We'll be back with more on this. Spain's just the tip of the iceberg.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And you've got to hear Ricky Santorum trying to spin this stuff. Share that with you, too. So at the beginning of this austerity thing, this let's slash and burn, let's take programs like Medicare and convert them to voucher programs, let's turn everything over to the private sector, let's get government out of the way, right? At the beginning of this thing, as I mentioned, Spain's GDP to debt to GDP ratio was 36%. It's now closing in on 84%. Italy, was at 105% when this whole thing started in 2009. They've been doing austerity now for 2 years, 2.5 years. They're at 126% right now, according to today's New York Times. Greece was a little over 100%. They're at 160% now. Their economy shrank 7% in the fourth quarter. Greece's did. And 6.8% for all of 2011, all of last year. I mean, this is insane. And then, irony of ironies. The New York Times says, or this article in the New York Times, I mean, this is just straight up reporting, Landon Thomas Jr., says, some experts predict, they're talking about Portugal and other European debtors. Well, in fact, I'll read you the whole sentence. It's brilliant. If Portugal and other European debtors find it increasingly difficult to pay off their creditors because of slow or no growth, some experts predict that they, too, might eventually need to negotiate debt write-downs. In other words, they could never, you know, from the get-go, you're not going to cut your way to prosperity. You're going to cut your way to destruction of your economy. So if you're trying to do this so you can pay back debts, it ain't going to work, and you're eventually going to have to go to your debtors and say, okay, sorry, guys, you're going to have to take a haircut. And then the next sentence in the New York Times, that was how things played out in Latin America in the 1980s. Once it became clear that the IMF's relentless austerity push was impeding the growth the countries needed to pay down debt. Duh. Right? I mean, you get this? And this is the Republican vision for America. It's absolutely incredible. So, and then here's how the Republicans lie about it. If you are a member of the United States Congress and you are under 65, which most of them are, Ricky Santorum is under 65, then you basically have the federal insurance program where you know, there's a pool of health insurance companies and you can pick, you know, Aetna or Blue Cross or United Healthcare. There's a half a dozen of them or so, and you pick one. Right, it's the pool. And so here's, now keep in mind, what Paul Ryan said was if you're over 65, then instead of giving you Medicare, which you paid for throughout your working life, instead of giving you Medicare, we're going to give you the opportunity to buy private health insurance with a voucher. Got about a voucher for you here. And then you can go out in the private market and you can buy health insurance if you're over 65. Can you imagine, you know, grandma sitting around here at the age of 75 or 80 with five pre-existing conditions and on 8 or 10 drugs, getting a voucher in the mail from the federal government and having to go through the websites of a half a dozen health insurance companies and talk to a bunch of insurance agents and make a comparative plan and analysis and then figure out how with that $8,000 voucher she's going to buy a $25,000 a year policy? Because I guarantee you can't insure grandma for $8,000. But this is what Rick Santorum had to say. And just catch the lie here. He's not talking, you know, the lie is that Paul Ryan said, let's turn Medicare into just another, you know, we're going to take the people on Medicare and throw them out there and say, you have to buy from a pool, just like people under 65 who are members of Congress do, or just like anybody does who's under 65. You have to buy health insurance, and you might get it through your employer. But here's Ricky Santorum. Here he is.
How many people here, if you were on Medicare, would like to have the same health care plan that members of Congress have? Guess what Paul Ryan's plan is modeled after? Members of Congress plan. It is the same model. Exactly the same. It says, because members of Congress have the same plan as every federal employee, which is a pretty good plan. Federal government says we're going to pay you so much. You go out and you pick from a booklet about this thick of all these different health plans. So it gives everybody a pretty good opportunity to go out and get what they need, what they think they need.
Right. Isn't that great? Grandma? I realize you can't see all that well, Grandma, and you're getting a little, in your pushing into your 90s here. It's kind of hard to move around with that walker. But we got this program where we're going to give you some money and you can pick the health insurance plan you want. Isn't that great? And then he goes on to just lay down some invective about anybody who thinks they know so well these elites, these liberal elites who brought us Medicare, that we're going to provide health insurance to people over 65 because we know what's best. Here's Ricky Santorum.
President Obama and the Democratic National Committee have termed this plan as throwing grandma off a cliff. Why do they term it throwing grandma off a cliff? Because you are incapable of freedom. They don't believe that you can make these decisions. They need to make these decisions for you. Because if you are left to make decisions, you will obviously jump off a cliff. Don't you see how they see you? How they look down their nose at the average Americans? These elite snobs.
Yeah, those elite snobs. You know, like Richard Nixon, who proposed Obamacare back in 1973. Those elite snobs. Those elite snobs like Franklin Roosevelt, who brought us Social Security. Those elite snobs who say that employers have workplace safety rules. Those elite snobs who want to have the federal government inspecting your meat. No double entendre intended. Literally, inspecting your food. And the sad thing is that when you look at the audience reaction to the audience who's listening to Rick Santorum, who doesn't realize that what he's saying is, if you're over 65, you're going to be on your own. Because we're not elite snobs. We're just owned by bankers on Wall Street and health insurance multimillionaires who are not elite snobs at all. They may own private jets, but they're definitely not elite snobs.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
What are we going to do with these elite snobs? Well, like these bankers who are, and these Republicans who are telling us, let's cut our way to prosperity. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. So, I find myself often just astounded by what's going on. By Rick Santorum saying, can you replay just the last 15 seconds of that clip, Paul, of that second clip? Just the last 15 seconds or so. Here he is.
Because if you are left to make decisions, you will obviously jump off a cliff.
Right. No, it was pushed.
Don't you see how they see you? How they look down their nose at the average Americans. These elite snobs.
Now, you know, I'm not going to make parallels between that kind of rhetoric and the kind of rhetoric that was directed at other ethnic groups in other European countries in the era of my grandparents. Instead, I would like to draw a parallel between that and, say, Joe McCarthy. Or... I mean, where do you start with that? Somebody who wants to make sure that grandma has Medicare is an elite snob. And somebody who wants grandma to have to buy her Medicare from a health insurance company whose CEO made over $1 billion with a B. That person's not an elite snob. That person is... I guess the opposite. I'm telling you, I just, America is at a space that is like nothing that I've ever seen. You've seen it around the fringes my entire life. I mean, when I was a little kid, my dad took me to a John Birch Society meeting. You heard this kind of rhetoric. I used to know some guys in the Michigan militia. You'd hear this kind of rhetoric. But a candidate for president of the United States? Who's the leading Republican? Joyce in Cornville, Arizona. Hey, Joyce, what's on your mind?
Hey. Hi, Tom. Hey, love your show. Listen to it every day.
Thanks.
I wonder if you could explore a little bit further the whole austerity slash debt crisis, which seems to me to be pretty obviously constructed out of what I think is just an opportunity by the IMF, et cetera. There's got to be some long-term strategy beyond
there is
eviscerating billions of people as well as certainly they're not stupid. They must know the history and how debt only increases.
Yes, they do.
What's the long term? You know, in my view, the ultimate goal is total privatization.
That's
right. Selling off of the commons, the selling off of public institutions, structures, etc., leaving us with a world in a world where there is absolutely no bulwark between the vast majority of us who will suffer and die, and a few ruling elites.
That's right.
And it's dark, but I mean, if you could.
No, Joyce, and I'll go off on it right now. Thank you for the call. Good setup. Back to that New York Times article. Okay. This is a different one. This is the Financial Times from today's Financial Times. And I know that every single line is slammed right now. I will get back to your calls in just a moment. But this is so good. And Joyce asked the question of the day. Why are they doing this? You can read this in today's Financial Times. It's by Tom Burgess in London and Chris Bryant in Frankfurt. It's titled Greece's Economy Shrinks. Greece's recession worsened at the end of last year. The economy contracted by 7% in just 3 months. Greece's economy has now shrunk in every quarter but one since mid-2008. The outrage spilled onto the streets in the weekend. And then they say, you know, this is not just hurting Greece, because the Greeks no longer have money to buy things. They're not buying things from other manufacturers in Europe who were importing into Greece, who were exporting to Greece, right? So, again, reading from the Financial Times, the Greek debt crisis is spreading through corporate Europe. Franz Fehrenbach, the chief executive of Bosch, B-O-S-C-H, you know, the world's largest car parts supplier. You ever bought a spark? I bought so many Bosch spark plugs in my lifetime, I couldn't begin to tell you. And on Tuesday, urged Greece to leave the EU and go back to the drachma. A German magazine, Monetary Magazine, in other words, the manager's magazine, it's like their business magazine, Inc., you know, that kind of magazine. German magazine said 57% of the 300 German manufacturers it surveyed were in favor of Greece reintroducing the drachma. Get your country back together, guys. In fact, Mr. Fehrenbach's comments, again, quoting from the Financial Times, today's Financial Times, Mr. Fehrenbach's comments follow revelations last week that leading companies, including drug maker GlaxoSmithKline and telecom groups Vodafone, have started to withdraw cash from Europe's more fragile economies every day. Then it gets interesting. However, there is a fillip, fancy word for kind of an upside or a relief, for Eurozone leaders in their efforts to increase the firepower of the currency union's rescue funds on Tuesday, when Wen Jiabao, China's prime minister, reaffirmed Beijing's interest in investing in them. He said this is a quote from Mr. Wen, he said, China is ready to get more deeply involved in participating in solving the European debt issue. Now, this is no knock on China. China's got a lot of money right now, and it's not just China, by the way. There was an article in, I believe it was the Financial Times on Saturday, the Weekend Times. It might have been the New York Times, but it was one of the newspapers I read over the weekend about how transnational corporations and other countries, particularly countries like the Asian countries, China, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, they're looking at Greece as a new port. They're buying up land in Piraeus and you know, the government's being encouraged to privatize things like their ports. Piraeus is the giant port city. I said a couple of days ago, I once met a Greek ship owner. He was the guy who owned the Kyros lines. And I was negotiating on behalf of a German travel company, Apfelreisen. And I spoke English and German, and the owner of the German company didn't speak English or Greek. And so I was there. It was a favor to a friend. I wasn't paid for this, but although I got a free trip to Greece. But it was, like I said, it was a favor to a friend. And I went into this meeting. First of all, this guy made us, this was a multi-billionaire, Greek multi-billionaire. And he made us wait like 4 hours in this huge outer office with his secretary with this, you know, 2-inch thick pile carpet. And finally she walked us into the office. And there was this long office. It must have been 80 feet long with these old master's paintings hanging along the side, and completely empty, most of it. And you had to walk this whole thing down to this massive desk at the other end, where this ship owner was standing behind the desk, this kind of giant bear of a guy with big fuzzy eyebrows, and leaning on his knuckles on the desk, leaning towards us. And we walked all the way there, and there were two chairs there for us, and we stood there, and he was standing, and of course you don't sit down until he sits down, and we just stood there and waited for him to speak, which is the polite thing to do, and he just stood there for this long, long time. I mean, this guy knew how to play power games. And then he finally said, "What do you want from me?" And that's when, you know, Herr Rahl said, "Well, we'd like to lease this ship from you." It was a leisure ship. But anyway, so I've been there. I've been in Piraeus. I've been engaged in negotiations over the shipping business. I've seen this. And what this article described was that the Germans and many of the Central European countries, the wealthier Central European countries, particularly Germany, which has no seacoast, they view Greece at the way that Americans view Florida. And so if they could build resorts there, if they could turn Greece into the European Disneyland, and of course the Asian countries, the exporting countries, China, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, they're looking at Piraeus, which is this the biggest port city in Greece, and saying, "Hey, you know, we can buy this, we can upgrade the ports, we can, and this is an entryway into Europe. And we can ship all kinds of stuff into Europe via Piraeus." I mean, they're already doing it, but even more. And not only that, instead of the Greeks getting the money from running the shipping business, it could be the Chinese or the Japanese or the, you know, or fill in the blanks, the Brazilians. We used to play this game, the Americans. I mean, we built the Panama Canal, right? I mean, we built ports all over the world. We had the Philippines as a big port, as an entryway into Asia, and on it goes. So now other people are playing the game. So that, in answer to your question, that is the end game. The end game was laid out by Naomi Klein in her book on disaster capitalism, and I believe that was the title of it. It's been 5-6 years since I've read it, but you know what I'm talking about. And Naomi Klein laid this out in a brilliant book in which she basically predicted everything that's going on right now. And that's the end game. Let's hand the ports off to the big transnational corporations, or in the case of countries that combine the national interest with the corporate interest, like China does, let's hand it off to, you know, sovereign wealth funds or sovereign, you know, corporations. Let's turn Greece into Disneyland. And Spain, why Spain? Well, Spain's got all this sunshine. If Greece is the Florida, Spain is the California.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
What you are watching is the rob, rape, and pillage of Europe. Now back to your calls. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 10 minutes before the hour, and Michael in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. Talk about historic towns. What's up, Michael?
Hi, Tom. Hi. Listen, I think the big elephant in the room is population control. Nobody's talking about that. Everybody's afraid to talk about birth control, but a lot of our issues today are the result of too many people, or too many, you know, 7 billion people in the world, and how are we going to feed all these people? And I think that a lot of our issues today are tied to a lot of people.
I agree with you. So then the question becomes, I agree with you. So then the question becomes, what do we do about it? And the prevailing wisdom, back when Paul Ehrlich wrote The Population Bomb in the 1970s, the prevailing wisdom was that the way that you decrease the average size of families is, because that's the driver of population growth, is by making birth control more widely available to families. And, you know, I don't think, frankly, it's a coincidence that shortly after the population bomb came out, you had the Roe v. Wade decision and things like that. And there was a broad expansion of access to everything from birth control to abortion in the United States. And it turns out that while, you know, you can make a strong argument for birth control being available to people, particularly to women who are the principal users of it, and you know, so that they can have choices and things, that's not what does it. That there are countries in the world, principally in the Middle East, but there are other examples, where birth control is widely and freely available pretty much anywhere, and even abortion's available, and yet still you have 11 or 12 kids in an average family. So it's not that. I'm not arguing against birth control being available. I think that it should be, but there are people who think that, you know, our mission, if we're going to stop population growth, has to be to spread birth control to the seven corners of the world, and that's going to solve the problem. Well, that might be a nice thing to do, but it's not going to solve the problem. Then another group, so when that became obvious in the 80s that just birth control alone wasn't solving the problem, then this other theory came along. And that was that when you look at the Northern European countries, when you look at the white, largely, well, not just white, right across the board, when you look at people moving into the middle class and the upper classes, economic classes, they tend to have smaller family sizes. Japan got very wealthy as a country, and their population's actually been shrinking for the last 20 years. So their theory was, we just need to make everybody rich, or at least as rich as the middle class. And there's two problems with that. One, if everybody in the world had the standard of living, all 7 billion people had the standard of living that is the same as that of an Appalachian family of four, living at the level of poverty, you know, $14,500 a year for a family of four. If the entire world was living at that, keeping in mind that of these 7 billion people on the planet, about 5 billion of them are living on $2 a day or less. If everybody on planet Earth lived at the standard of poverty in the United States, you would need four planet Earths to provide the raw materials. So that's impossible. So that's not going to solve the problem. But beyond that, those same Middle Eastern countries where birth control is widely available, you've got oil-funded governments giving people $30,000, $40,000 a year simply for being citizens, and they're still having 12 babies. So it's not wealth. So then the question becomes, well, what is it? What is it that causes population to stabilize when people move into the middle class or when they move into the upper economic classes or when a society becomes more level and wealthier like Japan, where there basically isn't much poverty and there's not that many rich people, but there's a huge and strong middle class and a shrinking population? What causes that? It turns out that it's one thing, and that is the empowerment and education of women. And so if you're concerned about the population explosion, or to use Paul Ehrlich's phrase, the population bomb, then the crusade that you should be on, Michael, is to get as many women as well educated and as empowered, politically empowered, like in Norway, where they say that 40% of their parliament has to be female, politically empowered as possible, because that will stabilize the world's population and actually start causing it to shrink. Making sense?
Yes.
Okay, good. Yeah. You have your assignment. Thank you for the call, Michael. Great to hear from you. Let's see. Jane in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. From Pennsylvania to Pennsylvania. Hey, Jane, what's up?
Hi, yes. I was having an argument with somebody about the what I call the climate crisis, because I think it is a climate crisis. And this gentleman said to me that he's not really sure which side to believe, because he understands that the oil companies have an interest in denying the global warming, but
and
he
the coal
feels
companies.
That science, yes, oh,
and the natural gas companies,
and exactly, yeah, basically all the entire fossil fuel industry, and but he believes that the scientists also have a financial interest because of grant money coming in, and I really wasn't exactly sure what to say to that, so I wanted your help.
Well, it's a bizarre suggestion that the reason scientists are putting forward global warming is because they want to get their research funded for another year. First of all, the climate is changing radically. They're going to get their research funded, number one. Number two, most scientists are not funded by grants. They're working for the federal government, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. The leading spokesperson on this stuff, James Hansen, works for NASA. He's not working on grants. He's a government employee. The ones who work in universities, they're not working on grants, they're government employees. There's a very small section of scientists who are working on grants. And that's like saying, you know, The reason why we have polio vaccine and the reason why the medical industry is developing, you know, more vaccines for new diseases is because you got a bunch of greedy scientists who want to have grants. The reason why the United States government funded the development of microchips, DRAM chips, the early memory chips, I mean, the original Apple computer, both the hardware and the software. The hardware was developed based on chips that Motorola was making that were funded by the Department of Defense, and the software was based on the StarMic operating system, which Xerox had developed for the Department of Defense. The reason why the government funded the development of computers was so that computer scientists could get grants, and they were out there lobbying for it. I mean, it's an absolutely bizarre argument. People are going to do something good because they want to get grant money. And if this is the best they've got, it's pretty pathetic. Yeah. I mean, it's profoundly pathetic. Speaking to that, we now go over the thinkprogress.org. The Center for American Progress broke this story yesterday. The Koch brothers fund this thing called the Heartland Institute. We've had them on this program before to debate global warming. They're global warming deniers. They're producing textbooks for our schools about the great global warming debate. We are the only country in the developed world where there's any debate at all. Thanks a lot for your call, Jim.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And the pressure rises on the private equity boss's tax rate. There's this special sweet little deal that got slipped into the tax code during the Bush administration that says that if you're a hedge fund manager, you pay a maximum 15% income tax for handling other people's money. Now, if you're an insurance agent, middle-class insurance agent, you could pay up to 35% federal income tax for handling other people's money. Or if you're an investment advisor working at, you know, a local investment shop, you could pay up to 35%. But if you're a Wall Street hedge fund manager, 15%. It's pretty much only for multimillionaires and billionaires. And what a sweet deal it is. And the president is talking about undoing that with the Buffett rule. And there was an interesting article in the Financial Times today, front page of the Financial Times, in fact, about how internationally governments around the world, particularly in Europe, are, because England has a similar, you know, did a similar tax break during the Blair government, saying this is crazy. So let's ask Chris Murkowski about this. He's watchdogonwallstreet.com is the website. He's an investment banker, talk show host, and author. You can read all about it at watchdogonwallstreet.com. Chris, welcome to the program.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me. I'm actually one of those little registered investment advisors that you talk about that has to pay a higher tax rate.
Okay. So you don't call your income carried interest and pay a maximum 15% income tax rate?
No. I'm not commingling my funds with my clients' funds. And that's the difference between the two. A hedge fund guy is basically running a fund where they also often have a vested interest in this carried interest deal.
Well, why don't you just say to all your clients, you know, I'm going to throw $5 into your pot, and you can keep all the profit from it. I'm just doing it because my tax rate's going to drop from 35% to 15%.
Because that would be illegal for me to do that because everybody's different. I'm a financial planner. I'm not one of these guys, a hedge fund guy. I've been going after them for a long time. They're basically gambling. They pick a certain direction that they're going to go, and sometimes it works. And sometimes it doesn't work. And yes, there's the carried interest tax deal there that most certainly needs to be dealt with.
But have you ever heard, Chris, of a hedge fund manager going down in flames? It's like when it doesn't work, their customers get screwed. But they don't.
They do too. There's no doubt about it. Yeah, there's a lot of hedge fund guys that have lost an absolute fortune. More often than not, yeah, sure, their customers are really bearing the brunt as well. But yeah, there's been plenty of these hedge funds that, when they blow up, the hedge fund guy blows up with them.
But the management fees that guy has taken along the way have more than made up. I mean, I've never, ever heard of a hedge fund manager who has been reduced to standing on the corner in New York City with a tin cup and a sandwich board that says, you know, brother, can you spare a dime?
Oh, you're not going to get any argument from me there. But the reality is, you know, they're able to operate in a different world, and they're the ones that are getting a lot of the business from a lot of government pensions, union pensions all over the country, and this is why they're often mismanaged, because they take these guys out on nice golfing trips to the Bahamas, and they can get a lot of business off them. I mean, the whole industry in of itself is very, very difficult. They're not allowed to market, and it's very difficult to actually determine what these people's performance is. But once again, nobody's holding a gun to anyone's head and saying, hey, you know, invest in this hedge fund.
No, but that's not the point.
Due diligence needs to be made.
I think this has nothing to do with whether or not Americans should be allowed to invest, because we've had investment advisors, investment managers, we've had fund managers functionally since the founding of this country. I mean, there was a healthy trade in the 1790s in stock in the East India Company, you know, that was being conducted in New York. So I was in Sweden a couple of weeks ago. And in Sweden, and this is from a piece in the Financial Times yesterday or today, I believe it was, but it echoes what I had, you know, a bunch of politicians on the show, and one of them told me about this, and I thought, whoa. But let me just read you this one sentence from yesterday's Financial Times. In Sweden, tax authorities are pushing key executives from Nordic Capital, IK, and Altor. That's their equivalent of, J.C. Morgan Chase, Goldman Sachs, and Bank of America. It's their biggest fund companies, or Paulson and whatever his company is. You know, anyhow, authority are pushing key executives in Nordic Capital, IK, and Altor to respectively pay a 56% tax rate on income tax plus a 40% penalty tax on past profits instead of the 30% capital gains rate that they have already paid. Now, they pay 30% in Sweden, but everybody else pays 56%, and they're just trying to raise it up to that. Why are we so insane in the United States that we say having these guys have this 15% tax loophole is a good thing?
Well, I don't know how that whole, you know, 15% tax rate got, you know, tossed into the mix. I really don't. And I have no problem with making tax rates fair and equitable across the board. And I think that's a fundamental problem we have with our country, is that we're not equal under the law. And it's not just in regards to hedge funds.
Oh, yeah.
I own a small business, but I most certainly cannot afford, nor most of my clients, which are small business owners all across the 50 states, to spend, you know, ridiculous sums of money to put out a 19-foot, you know, tax return like General Electric was able to do and pay nothing.
That's right.
And I think this is where the frustration comes from, is that we're not equal under the law,
well,
and we're supposed to be.
Yeah, I agree with you. And here's the problem, is that the reason why GE could put out a 19 feet long? Really?
19 feet high, if you were to print the thing out.
19 feet high? Holy
yeah.
Cow. I'll bet that a large, you know, a not inconsequential chunk of that was legislation that was proposed by General Electric to specific lawmakers, along with campaign contributions or you know, nice trips to Ireland or something. And those guys got that into the law. I mean, the big companies these days, it's like, you know, Foster Freeze. The guy, the billionaire who's behind Rick Santorum, he was at the Koch brothers convention where they had a whole bunch of billionaires get together about 3 weeks ago, and they had this kind of auction, and they pledged $100 million of their own money to take down Obama in the upcoming election, to hand off to, like, you know, Karl Rove's pack and things like that. And Foster Freeze came out and he said, anybody, and I'm paraphrasing from memory, but this is pretty close to verbatim. He said, any of those guys who were at the Koch brothers event with me would find that Rick Santorum is a good investment, and they would get a good return on their investment. Those are the phrases he used, by supporting Rick Santorum because of his belief in the free enterprise system. And
I agree with you, but you have to understand that this also works for both sides, and it happens for both parties.
I'm not making this partisan.
Yeah. You know, that's what I'm saying. I'm saying this is an issue that needs to be.
Although I can tell you right now, there are no billionaires standing at the door of Senator Bernie Sanders' office. Instead, he's relying on Americans to go to Bernie.org and give him contributions. There's no billionaires standing at Dennis Kucinich's door.
But we both agree then that we need to completely reform the tax code, because the tax code is like the yellow sun to Superman for politicians, because that's where they get all their power from, because their ability to put loopholes in. A 70,000-page document to to manage the taxes for the United States is absurd.
Yeah.
And this is where we should start with, is tax reform, where it's fair and equitable across the board. Then you're going to do away with a lot of the people that are cheating and trying to get away with stuff, because people often feel like, you know, this one's getting away with it, so I'm going to try to get away with it. And it's a disaster at this point in time.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Well said. So where do we begin?
Well, I really think that you're going to have to start looking at getting rid of many of the deductions that we have there. I think we have to simplify the various different brackets.
Now, the president is suggesting getting rid of a whole bunch of deductions for big oil companies. He's like, why are we subsidizing oil companies? They already know how to drill oil.
Well, if they're getting, you got to understand, if you're an oil company, shouldn't you be allowed to write off your expenses if you're drilling and trying to find a new oil well when some other company is allowed to write off their expenses? It's nothing that's unique to an oil company.
Well, actually, there are
to entire industry.
There are unique exemptions just for the oil industry. The oil depletion allowance, for example. You don't have a tin depletion allowance or a gold depletion allowance. But anyhow, Chris Markowski, interesting conversation. People can read more about it at watchdogonwallstreet.com. Chris, thanks.
Have a great day.
You too.
Bye-bye.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back. So what do we do? How do we, you know, and should we take seriously this pressure rising on the private equity bosses? Or are they going to blow up our election? Minutes past the hour of talk media for the rest of us here. I find this amazing. Pressure is rising across. This is Daniel Schaefer in London and Richard McGregor in Washington, D.C., writing in the Financial Times. And pressure is rising across the globe. Oh, this is the front page story. This is on the front page of today's Financial Times. I didn't bring my paper in with me, but I read it this morning at home. Pressure is rising across the globe to raise taxes for private equity bosses, with German and Swedish authorities pushing for legislative changes and a leading U.S. pension fund investor calling the 15% tax rate in the United States undefensible. Both the German and Swedish governments are considering proposals to lift tax rates for one of the industry's profit-sharing schemes in what private equity executives say is likely going to trigger sweeping changes across Europe. Now, who's the guy in the United States who most does not want to see this on the front page of the Financial Times and most does not want the conversation to be happening in the American press or the American media? Who's the one guy? Now, you could argue, hey, you know, it's Paul Singer, the venture capitalist or vulture capitalist or whatever. Greg Palast calls him that. I don't know if what he is, but he's a big funder of Republicans. Or John Paulson, you know, guy who makes a couple $1 billion a year on Wall Street. You could argue it was one of them. Or that, you know, maybe it was Shelley Adelson, the guy who owns a casino in Macau, you know, off the coast of China, and takes that money and uses it to sponsor Newt Gingrich. Or maybe it's Foster Fries who's making his money. I'm not sure how he made his money, but he's a billionaire. And he's you know, pumping up Rick Santorum is now his front man. You could argue that it's them, but there's one guy out there who actually made his money as a private equity manager and continues to make his money, almost $30 million last year, as a private equity manager or from the equity in his private equity firm, and that's Mitt Romney. And this is why this is such an amazing and interesting time. And I don't think that it would have happened without the Occupy movement. That we are having conversations now, and by we, I'm talking about the whole world, that the German parliament and the Swedish parliament are actively debating, that the world press, the front page of the Financial Times, and you know, the Financial Times sells more papers in the United States than anywhere else in the world, even though they're based out of London. Pretty much, I mean, I used to read the Wall Street Journal until Rupert Murdoch bought it, and all the good journalists quit their jobs, and the whole paper became basically another Murdoch Fox News rag. So, the Financial Times is like, you know, if you want to hear rich people talking to rich people, read the Financial Times, and this is not an ad for it. They're not one of our sponsors. But there it is, right on the front page of today's Financial Times. Pressure rises on private equity bosses' tax, because they've got this tax loophole that Ronald Reagan used to talk about. Paul, can you easily get that clip of Ronald Reagan talking about that's crazy, that 10% tax? Because this is the tax loophole. It used to be, and then it went away, and now it's coming back. And it's just, it's amazing. I don't know how to describe it beyond that. That this is, in fact, the fourth paragraph of the article on the front page of today's Financial Times. They talk about how Mr. Obama wants these fund managers not to pay 15%, but to pay 30%. This is the Buffett rule. You know, no matter what your tax rate would be after you've created a 19-foot high tax return, you're going to pay 30%. By the way, here's Ronald Reagan talking about this tax loophole.
We're going to close the unproductive tax loopholes that have allowed some of the truly wealthy to avoid paying their fair share. They sometimes made it possible for millionaires to pay nothing while a bus driver was paying 10% of his salary, and that's crazy.
And that's crazy. Excuse me. And that... So anyhow, the fourth paragraph says Mr. Obama's position is in deliberate contrast to that of Mitt Romney, one of his Republican opponents, and a successful former private industry executive with Bain Capital. Mr. Romney's recently released returns show that he paid an average tax rate of 15% in recent years. So now the Republicans are going to say this is class warfare. How dare you attack the rich class? That's class warfare. And Ronald Reagan said, no, that's just crazy to say that billionaires should pay less taxes, lower taxes, fewer taxes than bus drivers. But that's what these guys are defending. They're defending the indefensible. And by the way, the Buffett rule doesn't even kick in until you've made your first million. So you can still have your 15% tax rate on your first $1 million a year. And $1 million a year is a hell of a lot of money. I mean, it's an amazing amount of money. And you pay a maximum 15% income tax, and Obama's going to let you keep that. And after that, you have to pay 30%. You know what you paid under Republican President Eisenhower? 91% after the first million. Actually, it was after, in today's dollars, maybe the first 500,000. You know what you paid under Republican Richard Nixon? 64%. No, 74%. I mean, this is, well, we will see how this plays out. But I'm telling you, if the president can continue pushing this Buffett rule, which is infinitely fair to millionaires, he's going to win.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And what's going to be so bizarre is to hear all these Republicans and these right-wingers saying,
president wants to raise taxes.
Well, yeah, after you've made a million a year. It's Viagra for your brain. The Tom Hartman Program does not, however, lead to stiff thinking. And don't let Limbaugh know, he'll want some. David in Rockford, Illinois. Hey, David, what's up?
Hey, and how you? Oh, well, I would ask you how you're doing, but I'm sure you'll get better anyway.
Was I quit coughing? Damn it! Yes.
I'm actually calling from Occupy Rockford. Well, uh-huh. and I had called you actually back in November and had given you a quick update about things that we were doing. Mm-hmm. And at that time, I also had mentioned that some of us were trying to take over the Democratic Party around here. Mm-hmm. We had about 70 empty precinct seats. And at the time, and I've got about 7 or 8 of them filled with some of my, you know, some of the people. So it's a slow process, but we're getting it. You know, we're starting to do that.
That's great. That's great. Congratulations.
Yeah, and we're also doing our second teach-in on the Citizens United case, actually, this weekend coming up at one of our local libraries on State Street. I'm sure anyone listening in the Rockford area will know what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have to go beyond that. And, you know, we had a fun time doing it the last time. Only about 5 people showed up. But that's all right. You know, you got to start somewhere, right?
Mm-hmm. There you go. Yeah, and good on you, David. Thank you very much for the call, and good luck. Carl in Mukilteo, Washington. Hey, Carl, thanks for listening to Talk 1090. What's up?
Hi, Tom. I was just curious, after all this talk about the IMF, and it occurred to me that I have never, in all the different stories that I've heard and seen about the IMF and and these global bankers, is that can anybody name a country that was in financial crisis where the IMF came in and actually did something positive? All I see them as is a perfect reverse Robin Hood.
Yeah, that's what they are. They're the front men for the corporate vultures around the world. They are, you know, they're the banksters' banksters. And I mean there has been a number of, I was going to say, you know, smaller countries, development projects that the IMF has funded that they would call successes. Smaller countries.
Have they actually ever actually rescued an economy in distress that didn't involve enriching a very small number of people and writing off debt?
Well, that's where I was going with my qualification, because even the successes, you know, where they've gone into countries like Bangladesh and some of the African countries, Southeast Asian countries, South American countries, and funded projects like dams or bridges or things like that, they tend to be, even the infrastructure projects, they tend to be projects that enrich a very small number of people, the large construction companies that are owned by the buddies of the banksters and of the local government, and they tend to create more crony capitalism and more verticalization of wealth in those countries. So it's a genuine, sincere question. It's a very good one, and I don't know the genuine, sincere answer to it. Off the top of my head, I can't think of any. But let me toss that out to Sean Taylor, our executive producer. It would be great for us, Sean, to get an expert on the IMF on to ask that question of, you know, have they always been the banksters, gangsters, and banksters, bankers, or have they done any good in the world, and what and when? Carl, thank you for raising a profound question, an important question. Michael in New York City. Hey, Michael, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, good to speak with you.
Thank you.
You know, I just wanted to give a comment. Good to hear that fellow from Occupy Rockford, I believe. I'm with Occupy Wall Street here in New York.
Good on you.
And
give our best to everybody down there.
Okay, I just want to ask one question. Okay, it's real, and I'm glad you're talking about taxes. You know, I haven't heard one mainstream media person, I haven't heard one debate, ask any of these candidates, okay, the Republican candidates, how to add to the deficit these dramatic, drastic tax cuts that they're talking about. It's totally insane, and nobody asks, and they have no historical proof based on Bush's tax cuts. It ran the deficit up through the roof.
That's right.
And the other thing, okay, and the other thing I wanted to say, you know, reducing corporate taxes, whatever it's from 25 to 15, okay, without deductions, why would their masters, who they serve, why would they be willing to do that when so many of them pay zero taxes now? Why would they be willing to pay 15 or 20% tax?
Well, the companies aren't going to be willing to. This is the logic that John Kennedy brought to the table in 1963. Well, and actually in 1960, he made the argument in the Nixon-Kennedy debates. It was actually done by Lyndon Johnson after he was assassinated. The Tax Act was in 64. But basically what he said was, he was a millionaire. He came from a family of multimillionaires, one of the wealthiest families in America. And he knew that they had all figured out 16 ways to Sunday to get around the tax code, and they weren't paying much in taxes, even though the top rate was 91%. So he said, if we want to increase collection of income taxes, in other words, have the rich pay more. This isn't from average people. This is from rich people. And he laid it right out. I've played the clip here a zillion times on this program from that debate with Nixon, where he even says, and with that extra money, we would build more roads, we'd build more hospitals. He goes through everything that he's going to do with that extra money. and strengthen the social safety net. But he said that what he said, I'm proposing a series of tax changes that would close loopholes, and in exchange for closing the loopholes, they'll lower the top rate. And so we're going to force people to pay the top rate, but the top rate's not going to be 91% anymore. It's going to be 74%. And in fact, when that went into effect in 64, tax collections on the rich went up. And, you know, revenue went up, and the 60s were a real boom time for the economy in the United States. And for some reason, Republicans keep saying, well, Kennedy lowered the top tax rate, and it helped America. And nobody points out to them, or nobody talks back to them. First of all, it wasn't Kennedy, it was Johnson. But secondly, that, I mean, Kennedy just advocated it. But secondly, he actually raised taxes on the rich by getting rid of a whole bunch of deductions that rich people and only rich people could use. And so if you do the same thing with the corporate tax code, if the corporate tax code is so full of holes, if it's so like Swiss cheese, that General Electric can produce a tax return that literally when you print it out is 19 feet tall, their tax return of the Internal Revenue Service, and thus not have to pay a penny on billions and billions of dollars in profits. If you've got that many Swiss cheese holes in the tax code, then let's just fill those things in. And I personally wouldn't object to dropping the top corporate tax rate from 35 down to 25%.
I agree with you. I wouldn't object either. But they, with all the lobbyists and everything, agree to all this?
Well, the Republican House of Representatives is obviously not going to agree to this. And it's not going to happen as long as the Republicans are in control, period. And I think that there's
even though they preach it, it's complete nonsense.
Well, of course, it always has been.
We want to flatten the tax.
It always has been. It always has been. I mean, you know, it always has been. And it's the Republicans. Well, not always. I mean, the first Republican to introduce an income tax, the first president to introduce an income tax in the United States was Abraham Lincoln, because he ran up this massive debt in the Civil War, and to pay for it, he said, let's tax the rich. And it was, and average people didn't pay any of that federal income tax. It was only taxes on the rich. And so, you know, that was when the Republican Party was the Reform Party, you know, and starting in 1864 when they were essentially created, and Lincoln was their first presidential nominee. And then by the 1870s, the 1880s, the radical Republicans were gone, the Reconstruction Republicans like Thaddeus Stevens, and they had been replaced by corporate Republicans, you know, J. A. Sanderson and folks like that, and Ulysses S. Grant, and on the list goes McKinley, and the corporate Republicans have been with us ever since. I mean, there was a little anomalous period there during Teddy Roosevelt's presidency when you had some actually progressive Republicans who called themselves progressive Republicans, but that's been the exception. So, Michael, we'll see how this plays out. Thanks a lot for the call. Robin in West Gardner, Maine. Hey, Robin, what's on your mind today?
Hi, thank you for talking to me. Two things. One is Social Security. I'm 55 years old. I'm very disabled. I went to Social Security. Yep, they just said, I am very disabled. I should get Social Security. However, because I make $25,000 a year with state retirement, I do not qualify Social Security. None. Zero amount of money.
Right.
Even though I'm very disabled.
Okay.
I don't get any Social Security.
Okay. So is there a question there, or did you just want to vent about it, Robin?
Well, no, I mean, it gets worse because then they made a mistake. They accidentally gave me money, and I had to pay all the money.
Oh, you have to give it back. Yeah.
And
okay.
It's awful. But
I get it.
My question really is more about this Keystone Pipeline.
Okay. Go ahead.
You okay?
Yeah.
I heard something in the news here in Maine a couple of days ago that they are thinking about putting a Keystone Pipeline. Well, not Keystone Pipeline, but they're thinking about putting a pipeline from Montreal to Portland, Maine, instead of the Keystone Pipeline.
Well,
do you know anything about that?
I mean, if they did that, it wouldn't be to bring the Alberta tar sands there, because they can't get them from Alberta to Montreal. That would be like trying to get oil from Denver, Colorado, because Alberta's way up there in the Rockies, you know, in the north, and you got the mountains all around it and stuff. And that would be like trying to get oil from Denver to Maine, basically, and via Chicago. Or if it's Toronto that you're talking about, via Detroit, you know, or if it was Montreal, it would be via Burlington, Vermont or something. Ain't going to happen. So I wouldn't worry about that. On the other hand, you know, it's not at all inconceivable that if there is oil in the central part of northern Canada, and there may well be, there used to be a lot of oil in Michigan and Ohio. They've pumped up all out of the ground by, you know, by the 1970s. You know, they started capping those wells. But in from the 1880s until the 1960s and 70s, major oil fields in Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania. That's why Pennzoil is called Pennzoil. It's Pennsylvania oil. We're not pumping that anymore because we've pumped it all out. It may be that there's been discoveries in the central eastern part, southeastern part of Canada that they're talking about bringing down to Maine. I just don't know. I'm sorry, Robin. I can't be your information source on that. But you might try the Google machine. We'll be back 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
How much longer is this austerity insanity going to hold not only the Republican Party, but the world? Back, Tom Hartman here with you, taking back the mainstream media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, right here, and right here, sitting next to me, Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. This segment brought to you, by the way, by Ellen's new book, Self-Empowerment, Nine Things the 19th Century Can Teach Us About Living in the 21st, by Ellen Ratner and Ann Gaiman. Hey, Ellen.
Well, okay, so the news, I guess, we'll start with some international news because Iran has been sort of top of the hit parade. And they basically said they have a new generation of centrifuges that they're going to be using, and they made a big splashy announcement. And then they also threatened to cut off oil to Europe.
Six countries in Europe.
Yes, and so the countries they're most mad at.
Right.
It's interesting because the Israeli ambassador was quoting the other day when I saw him from actually Amnesty International that says the equivalent of one dissident is killed every murdered, put to death every 8 hours in Iran.
Wow.
That's
when
depends
I hear
what
that,
you mean by dissident.
Yeah, when I hear that from Amnesty International, I'll take it a little more seriously than when I hear it from the Israeli ambassador, which is not to say that I have any doubts about Israel's veracity, but, you know, that particular individual.
But that was
still
his response,
yeah,
interestingly enough. And he said, you know, nobody cares. Well, that's just not true, obviously. It's a huge issue in Congress right now.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, today, the new budget director, Zenas, is I think how he pronounces his name.
By the way, if I can just walk back a little bit of what I said a minute ago, I did not mean that to defend Iran's human rights record, because they are
a terrible one.
Absolutely.
Right.
Okay.
Okay. So basically, he was defending the budget today on Capitol Hill. This was on the House side, and this is the Paul Ryan committee. And they were just after him, saying the Republicans saying, a budget is not a weak marker. Stop taking out the talking points. You need to have a scalable plan. I mean, they were really on him. And basically, he countered back. He pushed back on them. And he said, look, you know, in terms of this health care plan, do you really want to create vouchers that put people at risk in terms of their health care? Is this what you want to do?
Paul Ryan plan.
The Paul Ryan plan. And do you want to have Medicare block grants at a very low level? Because that's what you're actually talking about.
How did they react? I'm sorry.
Well, Paul Ryan then went, I could go on and on. I mean, it was a great piece of theater if you're into theater. Unfortunately, it deals with people's lives. And then he said, now we're hearing stabilize our debt. He said, before we talked about sustainable deficit, he said, this doesn't need translation. I mean, Ryan just went after him. Then they talked about energy taxes. And I think it was Deborah Wasserman Schultz brought this up. I'm not sure it was a Democrat, but I think it was her. And she said, well, you know, oil and gas taxes are at a record high, and what is happening to that? And he said, well, basically, in the budget, we have $30 billion that is taxpayer money going to help the oil companies that they don't need. And so the president pulled out that $30 billion in his budget. And then Wasserman Schultz did say this. She said, for every $2.50 in spending cuts, they have made for every dollar in revenue, in other words, they're not even doing extra revenue except to, when the Bush tax cuts expire, she said there's going to be $250 in spending. Did I say $250? $2.50 in spending cuts for every dollar of revenue. She said that's a pretty fair way of doing it. Hmm. But we're not dealing with fairness.
Interesting.
That was basically, he also said, and the Republicans have been putting out the fact that Medicare basically is not solvent in the year 2022, I think. They say 2036.
The Democrats.
The Democrats.
Yeah, and you could fix that by just letting Medicare negotiate prescription drug prices.
We have a very high lobby on Capitol Hill.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, some other things. By the way, Robert Zoellick, who's from the World Bank, we usually name the World Bank president, he's stepping down at the end of his term in June. The Republicans were going after today Leon Panetta. They did it yesterday in the Senate, today in the House. They said that this spending decrease is terrible. It's going to ruin, you know, America. And they said Obama's asking to do less with less, and they said that they're going to have their own new spending plan based solely on the needs of the military and not dealing with frugalness. Well, okay, they know when the president's budget comes out. It comes out the first or second week in February, came out this year the second week in February. Where's their plan? They're just grandstanding. They had plenty. They had the same amount of time that the president did to propose their plan, and they haven't done it. Okay, few other things. Roy LaHood, who's, as you know, son is stuck in Egypt, and is the Republican Transportation Secretary. He said he wants $2.2 billion to strengthen the backbone of U.S. transportation network, and originally there was going to be a vote on this. Now, it looks like, Speaker Boehner is going to wait to the end of next, to the end after they take the, Washington's Day, I mean, or whatever, it's President's Day recess.
Next Monday.
To vote on it, because of course Congress is
so they'll
out
vote
of
on it next Tuesday.
No, no, they're not. They're going to wait till after the Washington's
right,
the President's
so after,
Day recess.
After next
That's
Tuesday,
right.
After a week from yesterday.
That's right.
Interesting.
So
is he waiting on voting for this because he thinks that because he doesn't have the votes or because?
Well, I think because he doesn't have the votes. But what's so interesting is that they are going to put rail and rapid transit that's already in construction in a lot of red states. I mean, this was been going on for a long time.
Right.
Dallas, Denver, Houston.
You're talking about the president's transportation
this is
bill,
the president's
not
transporta-
the House transportation, not H.R. 7.
Right.
Yeah.
Because this is what they're, what Roy LaHood is recommending. And what I think is going to happen is what happened with the payroll tax cut. These guys are going to go back to their local districts and people are going to say, you know, where's the beef? Where's our transportation money?
Right.
And I think the president wins this one.
Fascinating. Fascinating. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by the new book, Self-Empowerment. 9 Things the 19th Century Can Teach Us About Living in the 21st by Ellen Ratner and Ann Gaiman. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Great to have you. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So yesterday, I believe it was yesterday, maybe it was the day before, in any case, recently I got a caller, I had a caller who was asking, who is John Maynard Keynes? What is Keynesian economics? How does it work? And I went through an explanation, and I'll just recap it very, very, very quickly because I want to respond to a comment in our chat room. I went through an explanation that pointed out that Keynes was saying that, you know, back in the 30s, that when you have an economy, that basically an economy is never stable. It's never just stagnant, rigid. It's always either moving up, cycling up, or it's cycling down. It's either growing or it's contracting. And if it grows too fast, then you get bubbles. which pop, and then you have contractions. If it grows slowly but steadily in ways that are healthy and sustainable, you can, you know, that's a good positive economic model. If it starts shrinking, that shrinking can feed upon itself. It's called positive feedback. Now, a negative feedback loop is like a thermometer, okay? The thermometer notices the temperature in the room and says, I'm set at 74, and it's only 70 in here, so I'm going to turn the furnace on. And when the temperature gets up to 70, it turns off. That's called a negative feedback loop. In other words, it's breaking the feedback. It's breaking the feedback to the furnace that says send more heat when it hits 74. Saying enough already. I got enough heat. So a positive feedback loop would be the opposite. It would be if the thermostat said send more heat, and when you hit 74, it said send even more heat. And eventually it's going to be 80 and 90 and 100, and then the house melts down, and the furnace goes into shock and whatever. So that's basically what happens with depressions. It's what happens with contractions. It's what happens with austerity. It's what happens with the kind of economics that the Republicans are trying to impose on the United States, and that the IMF and the EU are trying to impose on Greece and Portugal and Italy and Spain and Ireland. That if you lay off a bunch of people, if you cut the size of government, and 24 of our red states have done this now, over the last 3 years, they've laid off 700,000 state, county, and local employees. These red states, thinking, we'll have more money if we lay these people off. We don't have to pay their salaries. But what happens? Those people go from being taxpayers, which is, by the way, how the state gets their money, to being on unemployment. They go from producing things in the economy to consuming things. So what I said about Keynes was that he said you have to break. Well, in fact, let me take that one step further. So these people, they're no longer working. They're no longer producing things. They're no longer buying things. They're just, they're on unemployment, and that's it. Or in the case of, before Franklin Roosevelt came along, they were on nothing. They were starving. So what Keynes said was, the government should come along and should inject money into the system at the level of the consumer. Now, that's the critical piece that I think that the whoever commented in our chat room, Demo3, missed. Because Demo3 said, Tom was trying to stretch his mind around Keynesian and Austrian economics yesterday as I listened. With Austrian, he is right. You have to put your trust in the big corporations to spend or not spend the money. What he failed to say is that with Keynesian, you have to place your trust in the government where to spend the money. And I'd like to push back on this, because this is a common misperception about Keynesian economics. That the government is somehow deciding who the winners and losers are, and the government is somehow managing the economy. And Keynesian economics does not suggest either one of those two things. In fact, if anything, the opposite. John Maynard Keynes said, if you hired one guy to dig a hole and paid him to dig the hole, and then you hired another guy to fill the hole and you paid him to fill the hole, you could stop your country from being in this downward spiral of a depression. Now, why is that? Because you're putting money into the pockets of consumers who then go to the local store and buy things so the local store can afford to pay the salary of its shopkeepers. And then it has to buy things from its manufacturers who pay salaries to their employees who are making things. You've created the virtuous cycle. Keynes was not suggesting that the government should... was not suggesting that the government should go in and say, I think it would be a fine thing if we had a radio industry. And the reason I use radio is because in the 1920s, one of the things, the two things that fueled the bubble of the 1920s were land prices, because money was cheap and easy, and radio stock, RCA stock. RCA stock went through the roof. It was the Microsoft of its day. It was the Facebook of its day. It exploded. And it crashed in 1929. And a lot of the market was following RCA, because radio was the new thing in the 20s. So if Keynes had said, you know, we ought to have more radio businesses, then the government would be giving money to radio companies. But that's not what Keynes suggested, and that's not what Roosevelt did. In fact, if you believe in the wisdom of the marketplace, which is what the Chicago School and the Austrian School people pretend to believe in, what they really believe in is autocracy and plutocracy. But if you believe in the wisdom of the marketplace, then inject money at the lowest level in the marketplace, the consumer, and they will make their own informed decisions. They'll say, you know, I think I want to buy that radio rather than that radio. Or I want to buy this TV set instead of that radio. Or I want to buy this computer set. Or I'm going to buy a pair of shoes instead. They're going to make informed choices. Those informed choices are going to create demand in the marketplace. The demand market in the marketplace is going to then cause, you know, entrepreneurs to say, hey, there's demand here. Let's start this business. And on it goes. So it's not the government picking winners and losers. It's the government simply putting money into the system at the point where it's most needed. Now, Bush did the exact opposite of this when he bailed out the banks. He, instead of putting money in at the level of the consumers, Franklin Roosevelt, when homeowners were going in the tank, when they were falling apart, when people were losing their homes, Franklin Roosevelt created a Federal Housing Administration and said, we will loan you the money at a very, very low interest, and you can, you know, you can have your home. You can keep your home. And we'll let the banks go out of business. Or, you know, come back. I mean, most of the banks had failed within the first few weeks of his inauguration. But what Bush did is he said, to hell with the homeowners, to hell with the consumers, we're not going to put money there. That would be Keynesian. We're going to give money to the billionaire banksters. And they'll sort things out, because that's how they do it. And that's the difference between, or one of the principal differences between Friedman and the Austrian school guys, that between that kind of economic theory, which says, you know, trust in the big boys, versus John Maynard Keynes, who said trust in economics at the lowest level, just like Jefferson said trust in democracy at the lowest level.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And there's an absolute parallel between this economic concept and small-d democracy in the United States. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Jack in Concord, Vermont. Hey, Jack, you heard an earlier caller wondering if there was going to be a pipeline running from Canada to Maine, and you've got some information on that.
I certainly do. Hello from the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont.
Oh, thank you.
There's a little newspaper that comes out of Burlington, Vermont, called 7 Days, and they put out an issue end of December. And there's an article in here by a reporter named Shay Totten called Fight the Power. The first part of the article is about how our governor wants to give our power grid to Canada. But the second part of it talks about the pipeline through Vermont. The Portland pipeline runs through the Northeast Kingdom into New Hampshire, down to Maine. And there's a pipeline company in Canada called Enbridge that now owns a pipeline called Trailblazer that runs from the Alberta tar sands to Montreal. It's
really
recently closed, but they're they want to reactivate the thing. And then from there, there's a tank farm at the end of the Portland pipeline in Montreal and one in Portland Harbor. So the tar sands oil coming through Vermont and seems like a possibility.
Amazing.
Might be something you want to talk our, with our good Senator Mr. Sanders about.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, some of the environmentalists who are very, you know, Bill McKibben and some of the others who are very active on this. Very interesting.
Well, apparently there's just one problem with the Portland pipeline. It was built during World War II, and it's been buried ever since. But Enbridge owns a percentage of the pipeline, so, you know, coming in and replacing the pipeline would be pretty easy.
Right. Yeah, they've already got the rights of way and things. Fascinating.
Yep.
Okay. Thank you very much for the call, Jack. I appreciate it. Tom in Minneapolis, you disagree with me about Keynesian economics?
No, Tom, right at the end of your last segment, you made a mistake, and I don't think you believe this, but you said, and I think you're treading on thin ice, by saying that Keynesian economics and small-d democracy have similarities. And, you know, I've called them before where the Republicans often conflate and confuse economics with democracy, and I don't think you
yes.
want to go there.
No, that's an excellent point. And in fact, there are a lot of people on the right who think that economics is a political system and that capitalism is a political system for that matter. And it's not. It's an economic system. The point that I was making, Tom, and thank you for bringing this up, because I intended to go off on a little longer rant about it, and I got hit by the break. And then when I came back, you know, I went off onto a call. But let me just lay this out. Thomas Jefferson wrote at great length about the importance of democracy functioning at the lowest and most local level, that being the most powerful. They, you know, the ward system, you know, the county wards, the city ward, you know, community wards, that this is where the real power in America should lie. And all power then that is held all the way up to the presidency needs to flow from the bottom up and flow through a system where at every level it gets filtered by the decisions of the people. You know, in other words, elections. And so in that regard, the Jeffersonian democracy that we have, where every single member of the House of Representatives every 2 years has to stand for re-election, and the House of Representatives is the only body that can appropriate money and has a lot of other powers as well, that can declare war, for example, that's very much a bottom-up system. And that what John Maynard Keynes was suggesting in the economic world was a bottom-up system, and that what Thomas Jefferson was suggesting in the political world was a bottom-up system, and that what we have now, to a large extent, in the economic world is a top-down system, monopolies in virtually every industry, and politically we have a top-down system where you've got, you know, Shelley Adelson, who is the sponsor of Newt Gingrich, and you've got Foster Freeze, who, and tip of the hat to the folks in the chat room, who pointed out to me that he's a stock picker. He's a stock guy. Foster Freeze, who is the billionaire who's supporting Rick Santorum, and you've got Paul Singer and John Paulson and the Koch brothers, who are the supporters of Mitt Romney. And, you know, basically we've got, you know, billionaires running our political system and big corporations. You know, it's all become top down. It's all, everything is upside down from where it should be.
Am I still on?
You are. Are we in agreement now?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I understand what you were trying to say, and what I wanted to say was is that you hear this at Mitt Romney, where he's putting this on steroids on this campaign. He's talking, every time he mentions the word freedom, he always connects it to free enterprise, because most Americans think of freedom as democracy, but the Republicans want you to think of freedom as capitalism. And that goes off of Milton Friedman's book, Capitalism and Freedom, and he started all this with Ayn Rand and all that capitalism is superior to democracy, right?
Right.
And you can just hear it with Romney. He always, when he talks about freedom, he connects it to free enterprise.
Yeah.
Because they like that. The word freedom, the battleground is for the word freedom.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right.
And liberals think of freedom, we think of democracy. When conservatives think of freedom, they think of capitalism.
Yes.
And I think we just have to untangle that.
Yes, excellent point, Tom. Thank you for calling, and thank you for making it, and thanks for keeping me honest on this one. And I always appreciate your feedback. Tom's been listening to our program for many, 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 many of the 9 years we've been on the air here. Let me just make this point one more time. There's only about 40 seconds here before the break, so not enough time to get another caller in. But just to make this point one more time, that Keynesian economics is not about picking winners and losers. It's about saving an economy in free fall by putting government money, in many cases borrowed government money. It certainly was after World War II. It certainly was after the Civil War. Putting that money into the pockets of people at the bottom. And if you have to take it out of somebody's pockets, and this is what Abraham Lincoln did during the Civil War and after the Civil War, take it out of the pockets of the people at the top. And now I know that some right-winger is going to listen to that and say, did Hartman just say from everybody according to their means and to everybody according to their needs? No, I didn't say that. Not at all. Not even close. Not even close. What I'm talking about is simple fairness. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Back with more on lawyers, lobbyists, and political scoundrels. Stick around. Yep, that would be the good, the bad, and the very, very Kimpelageously ugly. The good. Texas County Court at Law Judge Bill Harris. On Monday, Judge Harris issued a temporary restraining order against TransCanada, the company responsible for the Keystone XL pipeline, from doing construction work on a residential farm in Paris, Texas. TransCanada has already used eminent domain to seize 89 properties in Texas for the Keystone project. TransCanada went after Julia Crawford's family farm in Paris, but she asked for the temporary restraining order stating that the pipeline is not a project that qualifies under Texas's eminent domain laws. There will now be a hearing next week on whether or not TransCanada can go forward with their eminent domain claim on Crawford's farm. While legislators in Washington, D.C. are puppets for corporate power in the pipeline project, it's nice to see that Judge Harris has a backbone and decided to stand up to TransCanada. The bad. Dr. Keith Alblow, a so-called expert psychiatrist for Fox so-called News, was interviewed on Tuesday as part of the network's War Against Media Matters founder David Brock. When asked to, quote, diagnose, end quote, Brock, Alblow stated,
he's a dangerous man because having followers and waging war, this isn't accidental language. It's about violence, destruction, and he feels destroyed in himself.
Alblow continued his quack diagnosis by saying,
this is an adopted boy who needs to plumb the depth of his psyche. He is adopted for some reason. This man feels he's unloved and unlovable.
Let alone the fact that no respectable doctor would diagnose a patient sight unseen. Alblow basically said that Brock was dangerous because he was adopted as a child. Alblow's incredible generalizations about adoption are offensive to anyone who's been adopted, and this type of quackery has no place in our media. And the very, very ugly Rick Santorum. Ricky Santorum likes to portray himself as an average Joe who cares about the nation's poor. Unfortunately, his charitable work says otherwise. A decade ago, he formed the Operation Good Neighbor charity with a mission statement to help homeless families, low-income families, and troubled children in Pennsylvania. However, according to the Washington Post, the majority of charitable funds raised went to run the charity itself, as well as to Santorum's political insider friends. Before it folded in 2007, the charity raised more than $2.58 million, with only 39% of that money actually going to help the citizens of Pennsylvania. Normally, a charity should donate somewhere upwards of 75 to 80% of its funds to its designated cause. While Santorum continues to be proud of the work, or lack thereof, that Operation Good Neighbor did, it appears that he was more interested in creating a scheme to pad the wallets of his political friends than actually help the people of his home state. And that is very, very ugly. Why is that ugly? Okay, we were talking about public debt. You know how much the national debt went up during the Civil War? 1,500%. 1,500%. It went from $64.8 million, which would be about $1.2 billion in today's dollars, to $2.2 billion, which would be about $44 billion in today's dollars. So how did Abraham Lincoln deal with that? Well, in 1861, He passed a 3% income on any tax on income tax on any income above $800. And a 5% income tax on anybody who lived outside the country, on any money they made at all. Now, back in that day, $800 was like maybe $80,000 in today's money. 3% on anything over $800. And then the next year, that was 1861. 1862, he dropped that $800 down to $600, 3%, and added a 5% rate on earnings over $10,000, which would be like $1 million in today's money. So, you know, there's a long history of, hey, let's pay our debts by taxing the people who have the money, taxing the people who made the money off the war. Tax the rich war contractors. Tax the rich railroad guys. Of course, there was some serious blowback to this. In fact, some would suggest that that blowback included John Wilkes Booth. I'm not one of those conspiracy theorists, but some of them are. Armin in Bradenton, Bradenton, Florida, isn't it, Armin? It says New York here.
Yes, but, Tom.
Lawyers, lobbyists, and political scoundrels is what Julie typed into the comment field here next to your name.
Absolutely. Tom, would you please, please let me read something real short and then ask you who wrote it. And then would you please, please, I won't take that long, just let me make a comment why I think we're where we are and things never really change the way. Okay. The road to achieving totalitarian corporate feudalism works best using libertarian window dressing at the start of the road and all along the parade route to the road's conclusion. That's what the Republicans are doing. That's what they've been doing for 40 years.
So who wrote that? I agree with
you. Who wrote it? I did.
Oh, you wrote it. Wow, you're a brilliant philosopher. That's a brilliant piece.
You're a brilliant teacher. May I say this, please, Tom?
Certainly.
The reason we're still here, Tom, to where you and I are very much disappointed and a lot of sympathizers and intellectuals on your side, that's also pretty much on my side. I agree with you a lot, more than you can imagine. The reason why we're still here, and things never get better globally, nationally, and we don't have solutions to all these problems.
I think a lot of things are getting a lot better, Armin. I'm not all that depressed, frankly. I think Obamacare is a good start. I think that, you know, the Economic Stimulus Act took us from losing 800,000 jobs a month to 24 straight months of job creation. I mean,
I'm tired of the wars, Tom.
Well, you know, we just ended the Iraq War, and
we'll end them all. But
yeah, well, you know, I am too, Armin. But it's man, you are so the glass is half empty, and I gotta tell you, this glass is half full.
I'm a perfectionist. I've always been that way. It's never good enough because there's always a better future. But may I please make my point,
sure. If you do so quickly, there's a lot of other people who don't.
Well, I want you to help me with this because I think that you'll agree with this. The reason why we don't have perfection and we don't have that dream of euphoria for everybody on earth and we have peace and everybody has all their needs met and security and we can build a beautiful future. The reason why, and I've studied history and I've listened to the right, the left, everybody, and the only conclusion that I can make is because always, always in our history, yesterday, a year ago, 10 years ago, 100 years ago, the people that have the absolute control are those, the ones that make the decision, are the people with the most capital. They're the ones that run the banks, they run the media, they run the newspapers. They control the food. They control everything. And capitalism has failed society from that perspective because it never succeeds in totalitarian euphoria, something I believe that we can have and we can better ourselves far better than we've done.
Okay, I got it, Armin. I got it. You're an absolute idealist, I got it. And you're an absolute idealist, and you think that we can have a totalitarian utopia. I don't. I think that you're always going to have different points of view. You're always going to have different opinions. You're always going to have this dynamic tension, and that in some ways that's actually good for society. And change comes incrementally. We didn't end slavery instantly. We didn't empower women instantly. We didn't, step by step. I go through a long, long list. It's taken us a long time to get to the point where we've got things like Medicare and Social Security and functional systems. But my glass is half full. Chuck in Novi, Michigan. Hey, Chuck, thanks for listening to WDTW. What's up?
Hey, Tom, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
In regards to your statement yesterday, and I heard it again today, about our number one manufactured export.
Right, it's gasoline.
Being gasoline.
Yeah.
Well, listen, I'm a union carpenter, and I am running for office, state legislature here in Michigan, and I want to know where I can refer people to go verify, because I tell them I'm sure they're going to blow it off to the liberal media,
yeah,
which exists.
Yeah. Chuck, I will
go to.
First of all, if you can probably find the link on our homepage the first day that I did it, because I had the Business Week article or whatever it was here that had the information. I don't have it in front of me right now. But you're right. That's a volatile enough statement that I should have the documentation right on the table in front of me all the time. I'm sorry I don't have it right now, but I will get it for you, and I will say it on the air. Okay?
All right.
Well, thanks a lot, Chuck.
We've definitely got to get the word out there on
that.
Yeah,
I agree. I agree. Thanks a lot for the call. And it's always good to back up what you're saying. Shane in Phoenix. Hey, Shane, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, I wanted to tell you about an interesting interview that I had read by David Barsman with Noam Chomsky. It's called Class Warfare. And he brings up some really good points about socialism that I think those people should know, that socialism is alive and strong, especially in conservative circles, and that we do have a powerful social safety net for rich people, and you can say it's in the form of tax loopholes or, yada, yada.
Yeah.
But when it,
no, you're absolutely right, and rich people can incorporate and get incredible tax benefits that average people can't. Yeah, excellent point. And the guy who's really written well about this, thank you, Shane, is David K. Johnston, Johnston. Check out his writings.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And how is Germany's economy doing? We'll check that out. Okay, I had a caller earlier who said, what's your source for saying the United States' major export is gasoline? It is the Associated Press, as quoted in USA Today on the last day of last year, December 31st, 2011, USA Today, in their money section, ran an article, and in that article, and it was quoting the Associated Press, they said, in the first, gas and other fuels are the top U.S. export. So Sue has, and thank you, Sue Nethercutt, for that. She pulled it out of our Daily Stack and slapped it in there. It'll be in today's Daily Stack. If you get our daily newsletter, the daily newsletter that Sue helps put together that is a work of art, has a link. It's got our Daily Stack. It's got a link to every article that I talk about, every issue that I talk about. And so that will be in today's Daily Stack, and you can track it down. So to the fellow who called, who's running for political office and wanted the source, there it is, Associated Press, USA Today, and I'm sure that they're quoting somebody else. And, again, I have the link. Sue has the link there. It'll be on our Daily Stack. I don't have the story in front of me, but close enough. So Marty in Santa Barbara. Hey, Marty, what's up?
Yeah, terrific to talk with you, by the way, because I've become a very avid listener and love the program.
Well, thank you.
Especially
thanks for listening to K-Talk.
Especially love your comments about the fourth turning. I read the book and just absolutely blew my mind.
Yeah, it's an amazing book.
I'm a real estate agent here in Santa Barbara, California. I've been in the business for many, many, many years, and I'm seeing the frustration of people who otherwise have the ability to buy but are self-employed. And the underwriting criteria, and I don't want to lose the audience, but you'll probably be able to follow me on it. The underwriting criteria now is inhibiting people of that are self-employed because of their adjusted gross incomes going up and down a lot from being able to qualify.
But hasn't that always been the case?
No,
I mean, other than during a couple of years of LIHR loans and stuff. I mean,
No. There are still things called compensating factors, and there was there were underwriters would understand that you had a high net worth. They would make adjustments and calculations for that, and you'd be able to get the loan in many, many cases.
Right.
So this was frustrating, and I thought that I could change that by coming up with an idea, and I played around with it. I ran this by the top economist in real estate in California. Her name is Leslie Appleton Young, and she agreed with my thesis on it. I wrote about 3 pages to her on it. And essentially what I would propose, and I think you should talk to Bernie Sanders about this and mention it, if you did one simple thing, very simple, loans would be given to people based on a 40% down payment on their home, and they need to have at least a 780 FICO score. It does not matter what income you make.
Right.
You would see the market take off in a matter of 6 to 8 weeks. You would see the supply drop, and the average investor could buy rental units instead of these bulk sales all going to the kajillionaire hedge funds that are putting together money to buy all these houses and rent them.
Well, this is one of the things, Marty, that is why the market is not recovering as quickly as it did, is because a significant chunk of the market. You know, the frenzy that was driving the market before was not people buying homes for their own use, but people buying homes as a way of becoming, you know, a millionaire. There were all these seminars all over the country on how to buy a house with no money down.
Precisely.
And
Tom, precisely. However, they were coming in with 5% down. The default rate, and this your folks can research this, is almost non-existent if somebody puts 40% down.
I would imagine. Yeah, if you had so much skin in the game, how would you walk away from that? I would think that the default rate would be really low at a 10 or 20% down payment, which, you know, back in the 50s and 60s, that was pretty much what was necessary.
Well, currently in Southern California, 30% of all the transactions that are taking place with all cash transactions. That tells you that people could come in with 50% down and buy twice as many investment houses.
Right. It also tells you that very, very, very wealthy investors are getting bargains right now. This is like the very wealthy people in the 1930s who bought homes and companies and ended up basically owning the American economy in the 1950s as we came out of the Great Depression.
True, but here's the thing: if individual investors could buy 2 and 3 and 4 houses, as they always have, and that's how people got going, all the immigrants and everybody have got started in real estate, many, many of them,
sure.
You would see the inventory start to drop. That would stabilize all the communities, and then we could go up from there. And this could be an observable change in 8 weeks, and it's one simple change. That's one simple. The banks won't lose any money. The taxpayers couldn't lose any money on it because if they underwrote it, there's no losers in this.
Who defines the underwriting standard? Those are not defined at law, are they?
What's that? The underwriting, those are Fannie Mae and Freddie buy the paper from the banks.
Not all of
it. Not all of it. But the banks don't have the waivers right now, or they've got better things going on, and they don't want to do this. It would be very patriotic for them, and they would make money.
Right.
Because you could even increase the origination points to a point and a half, and people would be happy to pay it. So what's happening is you're free. The entire housing market is frozen because the step-up market is not there. People who are middle class can't move up to the next level because the people beneath them can't buy, and then they can't buy from the people that are above them. And so you've got this protracted stagnation, which could be changed with that one simple thing. Dramatically, it won't cure everything.
Yeah,
but it would change everything, and it's so remarkably simple that I just cannot believe that it can't get done.
Well, here's why the banksters are not going to propose this, because if somebody puts 40% down, the bank is going to make a lot less profit on that loan. You know, I mean, the first 5 years of a mortgage are almost pure profit for the bank, and so the more that they can lend out. I suppose you could argue that people could buy bigger houses, you know, 40% bigger house, but then you'd have that debt-to-equity ratio. But a great suggestion. Marty, thank you. I appreciate it. I'm telling you, we have the smartest listeners on Earth. on this program. And thanks for listening, Cato. We'll be back tomorrow. Coming up on the Tomorrow on the Oh, we're going to be talking with John Nichols, The Nation magazine, about his new book, Uprising, How Wisconsin Renewed the Politics of Protest. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there. Get active. Tag. You're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.